The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members stay connected to the organization and become more knowledgeable about our community, mission, and programs. Thanks for spending time with us. We hope you enjoy this format and that you'll send feedback to media@100women.org.
Hi everyone, I'm Amanda Pullinger and I'm the CEO of 100 Women in Finance. Today I'm launching a podcast series to give 100 Women members the chance to become better acquainted with our board members. These are the people who steer our organization through sound governance and financial management, ensuring that we have the resources we need to advance our mission. It seemed appropriate that we kick off this series with Lauren Malafronte, who is the board chair of 100 Women in Finance. Many of our listeners will know her from her annual letter to 100 Women members or her appearances at 100 Women in Finance's large events, most notably recently at Buckingham Palace. But today, I'm hoping you'll get to know her as I know her, as a person as well as a leader. So in her day job, Lauren serves as Managing Director at Scotiabank, where she's responsible for their US clients across Global Capital Markets Division. She's enjoyed a long run in the finance industry, beginning at Lehman Brothers in the late 80s and including a stint at Barclays, where she ran client service for their US Prime Division. So welcome to you, Lauren. We're going to jump right in, but perhaps you mentioned where you're doing this call from today, and then they'll jump it right into the questions.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you, Amanda. So, and I'm so happy to be able to kick off this podcast. I have to be honest, I had to actually listen to my first podcast this weekend because I wanted to make sure that I knew what I was doing. But in any case, so I am speaking to you today from my home in Brooklyn. So, you know, I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up here in Brooklyn. So I'm home. My house seems a little bit like a regular WeWork because I have one of my daughters is home from school. But all good in my neck of the woods.
Great. Well, you mentioned that you are sitting in Brooklyn and that you're a native New Yorker. You know, one of the things I've been doing quite a lot recently is asking people to tell me their early life story, because I think you can learn so much about what motivates people and what makes them the person they are. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your upbringing, about your parents' expectations of you, and your pathway to being the person that you are today?
Okay. Well, I don't know. Where do I start? Let's see. I am the oldest of four. I have two sisters and a brother. I am the first in my family to go to college. Both my parents, well, are second generation. Both my parents' and families came from Italy, but neither of them had the opportunity to go to college. And so one of the things that was really, really important for all of us was to go on with our education. And honestly, they didn't really have any expectations. So we really almost, I felt like I had an open slate. And to be quite honest, I kind of tried a lot of things and I transferred schools a couple of times before I settled on what I was going to major in. But the things that, I think the one thing that my mom really wanted, she stressed to me to make sure that I learned how to type. And the reason was my mom was a secretary. Before, she only worked until she was, 7 months pregnant with me because that was all she was allowed to work at that time. My mother was a great typist. Both my parents, very smart and did a lot of things. But typing was really key. And she kept saying, if you know how to type, you will always have a job. But for me, that meant I would be a secretary, and I did not want that. And so I kind of refused. But then in my senior year of high school, they offered academic typing. And I thought, this could be okay. And my mother's like, you can use it. You can, you'll need to write papers and so on, which I did, which I have to say, out of all the things that, I think there's a few things that I've gotten specifically from my mom, never to leave the house without lipstick. And the other one was learn how to type, which has really served me well because, I wound up being a computer science major. I was a developer for the first 10 years of my career, and I can type really, really fast.
So So it's interesting that you said that you you kind of changed course a number of times, and you know, for many people listening, they're wondering how did you start? How did you go from being a computer scientist, programming to doing what you do today? So do you want to just talk a little bit about that switch, the period in your life where you went from doing computer stuff to what you're doing today, and how finance came into it?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, you kind of tipped it a little bit by saying that I started for Camp Lehman Brothers in the 80s. So you can imagine that was well before people had computers in their houses or on their phones. So I've been really fortunate, I think, throughout my career. And while I always kind of had a path of where I thought I wanted to be, I was always flexible. And I kind of fell into computer programming after thinking about law school, teaching, fashion, and just found something that I loved. And I loved, coding. I loved puzzles. To me, it was just a big, big puzzle, right? You know what you have to get to, and there's just different ways to do it. But at the time when I was, at Lehman, and again, this was now in, flash ahead in the 90s, computer languages started to change, right? So the language that I had coded in was, kind of becoming out of fashion, and newer languages such as C++, was more of in vogue. And while I, was keeping up with becoming more current in those languages, clearly I had started to kind of drift away. I was managing a team. I was really more focused on the business side, if you will, thinking about how do we take, you think about the financial services industry is very, very unautomated, right? Lots of ticket writing and so on. So I had there at this point, I really was working with the business folks and kind of on them. And I supported the securities lending business. And one of the managers said to me, anytime you think about switching, you have a job here. And I really hadn't, because I really liked what I was doing. But then I started thinking about having a family. And again, remember, this is before cell phones, before the internet. So you were tied to a beeper. And I just didn't want to do that anymore. And so I gave it a kind of a shot. And I was really fortunate that I was able to move into the securities lending business at that time. And I kind of never got out of it. I kind of stayed in sec lending and then moved over to the PB side and, and to where I am today. So it was really
Thank you for sharing that, because I think it really illustrates, again, what I said earlier about learning where people come from is really important. It makes me realize now why you are able to adjust and why you are so good at being in different situations and adjusting to those different situations, because those are clearly the pathway that you've already come and is part of kind of your family background as well. So thanks for sharing that, because I think it's something we all need to hear right now, is that actually we can be adaptable, and even though things change, we can actually we can find ourselves in a different place through this process by being flexible and as you say, learning how to type, which is very funny that your mother's view of that is very different from what ended up coming out of it. But good on your mum for suggesting it. So let's move on to 100 Women. And I met you almost 20 years ago now, can you believe? We were running the first gala in New York in 2002, and I was running the logistics for the gala. I joined the organization in 2002 as a volunteer. And actually the first time I met you was when we were both of us running logistics to get goodie bags from my then office apartment to the event on the night, and your responsibility was getting enough car services in place to ship all these goodie bags, and I think the car service providers were kind of wondering what on earth we were doing. But anyway, that was my first recollection of you, and again, being adaptable and figuring it out and problem solving. Since then, you actually ran a gala 1 year as chair, and then you know, you've attended many of the events. In fact, we added up how many events you've attended. You've attended over 70 education, peer engagement, and philanthropy events over the years. We checked in your profile. But your role has now shifted to being one of chairing the board and kind of wearing the governance glasses for, in that board role. So I'm just wondering, from those, you know, from those early days to now, how has your perspective around the organization changed? How has your thinking about the organization changed as you've shifted from a kind of an operational volunteer role to more of a governance role?
I think when I think back, you know, one of the reasons why I joined, you know, 100 Women was different than I think what I actually got out of it, right? I think, in the, you know, when I was first introduced to it, and it was early on, not the, you know, the first one ever, but clearly in the first couple of sessions, was really like, you know, my kids were young at that time. So I really didn't have a lot of extracurricular activities or time. And I had never really had done anything like this. But this is a good way for me to, you know, get connected to my clients, but then also, you know, kind of give back. And so the most natural thing for me was, how do I do this? And that was the, you know, logistics, if you will, right? And from there, you know, I went to be, as you mentioned, like your vice chair when you were gala chair, and then I became chair, then I moved on to the philanthropy committee. And I think, you know, when I think about the things that I got out of 100 Women are obviously some of the friendships that I have, which I think have a lot of them, but then also a lot of the access to so many of the wonderful things. I mean, still keep thinking about Buckingham Palace and, you know, how amazing it was to be not only in that place, but then with members from all over the world. And I think that to me is something that really like kind of hit like, wow, this is big. So it's like being, you know, part of the board and now chair, the things that I look at is, you know, how do we make this experience kind of the same for not only all of our members currently, but ones in the future, right? I mean, 20 years is a long time. It didn't seem like 20 years. And a lot of things happened, you know, kind of just natural. But we're so big now. We're really a company, if you think about it. And I think that's something that's kind of really interesting and challenging, is that this is a huge organization. We have a huge global footprint. And so how do we make it sustainable for our members? And not only sustainable, but also that everybody has that same experience, right? We have great programming. We have great supporters. And we really connect people, right? And that's kind of the thing that I was really fortunate to get. And I, you know, I constantly think like, and how do we make sure that everybody else has that as well? So
yeah,
I don't know if that's kind of answered your question, but
yeah, no, it does. And it's certainly what's on my mind, particularly going through this coronavirus crisis, is, you know, how can we not only continue to serve our members and the industry, but actually increase our service to members and the industry during a period where there's so much going on, so much uncertainty. So I really value your leadership around, you know, thinking through how we keep the organization growing and sustainable during this period of time. So thank you for that. We're going to come to something that's a bit more personal to you. One of the things that 100 Women members may not know about you is that, in addition to working at Scotiabank, you're also the proud mother of two adult daughters. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you about balancing parenting with a demanding role in the finance industry. But what I do want to ask you about is one of your daughters, Jane, is currently a midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, although I believe she's currently home with you, given what's going on. But so amazing that she's taken on that role, and somewhat unexpected for a young woman. From what I understand, less than 30% of the Naval Academy undergraduates are female. Would you tell us a story of why your daughter chose this path? and perhaps draw some parallels to what you see 100 Women is trying to do to achieve, you know, through our Investing in the Next Generation initiatives, really inspire more women to come into what is obviously a male-dominated area of finance. But tell us a story about how your daughter got involved with becoming a midshipman.
Yes, who is right now, I think she's taking her cybersecurity 12-week exam in my living room, but in any case, you know, so neither my husband nor myself are military families. I mean, both our dads were drafted and did serve, my dad in the Army for a few years, and my father-in-law were with the Navy, actually during the Korean War. But I wouldn't say that that was a big part of our lives as a family. But which was interesting. So both my daughters, were both athletes, Jane a bit more, competitive. She played two sports, you know, since she was very little. And in eighth grade, she was already playing, you know, varsity sports, you know, volleyball, softball. And when we were looking at schools, or she was looking at schools, you know, she was looking to get recruited to play softball. And, you know, both of my daughters went to Poly Prep in Brooklyn, which is a, you know, private school. And, they have info sessions for different colleges, like they do throughout all schools. But the service academies, specifically the Naval Academy, they come a bit earlier than most colleges. And that's because the process to apply is incredibly arduous and it starts a lot earlier than the regular colleges. So must have been junior year, January, you know, Jane's in class. We have no idea. We just get a text in the middle of the day. Oh, my God, this is it. This is where I want to go to school. And we're like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, and so many things were running through, and we found the story out afterwards. So the Naval Academy had come, and it was a woman admissions director. And all boys showed up, and there were no girls. And she had said to the college advisor, why are there no girls here? Don't you have any girls? Like, you know, their school's a pretty big sports school. Like, girls who play team sports like softball. Or, you know, he could have easily said no, but he knew Jane. And he knew her for a long time. It happened to be her own college advisor. Again, you know, being in the right place, right time, right? And he went and got her out of her Spanish class and said, I think you need to come here. And that was how she got hooked, and literally from that moment on, that was the only place she wanted to go to school. And, you know, and she went through the application process. She, you know, had nominations. She wound up doing an extra year of high school. She did it at boarding school, like a PG year as part of the Naval Academy Foundation. But I think the thing, and we, you know, we say this all the time to the college advisor. Like, if he had not thought about Jane to go get her out of class, how different her life would be. She'd be a sophomore right now at a good college. She would have been playing softball. But instead, she took this route, and it was because somebody sparked something in her. And, you know, now when I think of Jane and I meet her and her friends, and you've met her, right? I mean, totally makes sense. Like, at first, we were all thinking, like, what is she crazy? Like, do you understand? Like, you know, what's involved, right? This is hard in a lot of ways, right? You're putting your life on the line. You are not a typical college student. There's lots of rules and regulations. But if you meet Jane, right, she is the ultimate team player, right? She loves being on a team. She looks great in any uniform she wears. But I think the parallel is it was that one person saw something in her. And I think, you know, we talk about, you know, why are we focusing on, you know, the next generation and even pre-career, you know, it's because we don't know if each one of our members touched one person who may not have even thought about coming into this industry. Like, we have 15,000 young women who are right now in school that might say, I want to do this, which may not have been the case had, you know, someone didn't go and talk to them or think about them, explain, you know, what they do, or even just introduce something to them. So I do see a lot of, you know, I mean, the numbers are almost the same, right? They're, like, I think the numbers are actually less than 30% at the Naval Academy, but, you know, it's all it takes.
Yeah, no, it's really, thank you for telling that story, because I think it really does illustrate exactly what we want to do as an organization. And that kind of brings me to talk about the 20-year vision that we have, our 30 by 40 vision, where we want to see 30% of women in investment roles, or investment teams, around the world, as well as seeing 30% of women in senior executive roles, around the world. And so what you just said really, really speaks to some of that. You know, it does involve for us a reframing of the way the organization expresses itself. You know, specifically, we're adding investing in the next generation to our existing mission of empowering women in the finance industry. But I think it's really critical that this new vision that you know came about under your board leadership takes place at this time. And I'm just wondering, you know, what you think the finance industry needs to do to get to that 30 by 40 mission. What are the things you're thinking about as you think about how we get to that spot?
Oh, I mean, if you think about, you know, what a lot of, like, STEM programs, right, you think about, they've, and even technology to a certain extent, have really done a good job about reaching out to young girls to say, like, oh, this, you could do this, right? Like, I know I've even, you know, my daughters have gone to, you know, forums where they learn, hear from different scientists and, I keep forgetting what the name of that was, but it's like a program like that. We don't really have anything like that for the financial community. So unless girls are exposed to it, because someone in their family not only works in it, but actually talks to them about it. I mean, I have to be honest, you know, probably if you ask my kids, they probably still don't know what I do. And they grew up, you know, in this industry. So I think, you know, the financial, it's kind of hard to describe sometimes, right? I mean, we could take our kids to work and we can expose them to things, but it's really like, when you sit down and say, like, what is it that we do? So I think, you know, I think we need to reach them younger, because by the time that women, you know, young women are in college, they're already, to the most part, they've already formed what they want to do, right? Especially if you're, you know, now think about, you have to, in many cases, apply to business programs, you know, upon entry into college. So you're 18 years old and you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. Well, what about the girls who know that they wanted to do this? Then it almost becomes too hard to transfer in. Now, you can go to college and not major in finance and still, you know, potentially work in this business, but it'll just be harder, right? Because, you know, companies only look up, and, you know, I mean, with some diversity, but for the most part, everybody looks at the business school students and so on. So I think going back to, you know, to like starting younger, just because then we widen our pool of people who might be interested in this industry. But then, and making it seem fun and exciting and like, why do we want, and necessary, right? I mean, think about it. This whole, you know, coronavirus, I've had a couple of conversations with my own kids, right? I mean, if you think about, look what's happening to our economy. People are not working. Why are they not working? Because people aren't using services. So it's a whole cycle. And if we can like kind of make it like really understandable for like young girls, like how they can really, you know, do something good. Like, it's not bad. Like, making money on, you know, on Wall Street and, you know, working, you know, it's not just about your own personal wealth, but it's also about the wealth of this country, right? Which I think everybody's, especially now, is really going to get a kind of like, you know, crash course on, like, how do we, you know, stimulate our economy back? So I think if you think of all of that together, right? I mean, I think 100 Women has done an amazing job of really, you know, connecting women. But now how do we connect us and to like engage the younger generations to kind of come into this industry, you know, so that this way, you know, it won't be 100, but it'll be like 1,000 women that show up for, you know, an event, you know, someday. So.
I think it's really interesting
that
you use the example. Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's interesting you use the coronavirus example, but actually this is a moment in time where we can actually really illustrate where in the world finance is involved and see that it's everywhere. But I loved your point of about saying that, you know, going into finance should not be seen as, you know, an evil place to go, but actually finance is resolving issues for ordinary people, and during a period of crisis, I mean, that's where we have to look, isn't it? It's really protecting those that are vulnerable. And we are doing that through whether it's pension funds or it's endowments and foundations. A lot of those places right now are being put to work because, you know, the returns that they've got into their funds are being used to meet those that actually at this period of time are very vulnerable. I mean, you look at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, right? You know, they will have made investments that have actually created a return that enable them to do all the work that they're going to be doing around COVID-19 and various other issues. So I think it really is a good learning experience. So I think that probably is a good place to end. So thanks so much, Lauren, for spending some time with us. And for those that are listening, you know, we'd love to get your thoughts about this conversation and about our desire to connect with 100 women in finance members using podcasts. And you can always reach me directly at CEO@100women.org if you have any ideas or thoughts around this. So thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks, Amanda, and hope to see you soon in person.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members in the private section of our website, Community.